Buy with Rob is your best choice when purchasing your new home in the Puget Sound area. Call 360-710-9425 today and get started on the best home buying experience you will ever have. Go to buywithrob.com today.
I swear to God, this is better than anything on television.
Why can't we go to a movie?
A movie? That's not real. It's the same as television. Trust me, this is real.
Hello?
Podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Jay Bowman?
Approach and identify.
Hello?
I mean, you can't put a price tag on freedom. Always never forget that.
From the Buy With Rob studio, located in beautiful Silverdale, Washington, this is the Dave Bowman Show. Now, here is your submarine-qualified, well-coffeed, stuffy, elitist history buff host, Dave Bowman.
Hey, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today. Most of them far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, politics, and the news. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. Well, we will not be discussing the SCOTUS pick today. Why not? Because it hasn't happened yet. Johnny Bench was one of my childhood heroes. We have some things in common and even more now. In Japan last week, there was a series of executions. They remind us that terrorism is less about politics than it is about something else. And is Hillary Clinton actually thinking about running in 2020? Well, yeah, she's thinking about it. Here's how you get a hold of me. Text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 565-3283. The email is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and your preferred non-denominational web search engine. Eloqui cognitio. The greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. Welcome back. I feel like it's been forever since I've been here. I know. So what I miss? 4 days? Tuesday, Wednesday? No, we did Tuesday. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So I missed 3 days of vacation. But it seems like way longer than that. I can't tell you how much time I spent sitting here going, I should do that. And then I just didn't. Anyway, hopefully you had a good week. 4th of July was wonderful for us. We ended up out at the lake and just had a ball. Ben swam a good portion of the day. And then we just had an amazing fireworks show. I'm amazed at what people will put into a fireworks show. I really am. Especially non-professional fireworks shows. I mean, it's the expense people will go to hear some bangs and see some poof, 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 poof stuff in the air is pretty amazing to me. So we go with my cousin, Rob, and he does a show. I mean, he puts on a show. But even that's just the preliminary. The guy across the lake from them, I guess, I don't know what his deal is, but he spends a buttload of money on fireworks, and he does about a 15-minute show. I mean, it's right up there with any professional show you would see anywhere. And it's really good. And it was Ben was enthralled. He was at 9 o'clock. He was ready to go. He was crying. He wanted to go home. At 9:05, the fireworks started and he was just enthralled for an hour and 20 minutes. He had a ball, but it also, I have a hard time. His birthday is tomorrow. Turns 8 tomorrow. So it was this day 9 years ago that I got off the air. It was a Friday. I went home fully expecting to have dinner. My wife had texted me. She was making one of my favorite meals, spaghetti. And I didn't rush home, but I got home earlier than normal. I got home right around 6:50, 6:45, 6:50, somewhere in there. Normally, I was one of those people that would go in early, do all my other work before the show. And then as soon as the show ended at 6, I'd try to be out of there by 6:15 or so. Anyway, point being that I got home and I got out of the car and I started walking inside. And as soon as I got inside, she said, it's time to go. I said, go where? I just got here. She said, it's time to go to the hospital. I really wasn't expecting it that day. I guess I should have been. And so that started that adventure, which was quite an evening. Spent 9 months, 9 months with my labor and delivery nurse wife every day, every single day, telling me everything that could possibly go wrong. Well, this could happen, but it's not very likely. Well, this could happen, but it's not very likely. Well, that could happen, but don't worry about it. And then the night came and we get over there and of course things started going wrong. So I was not doing well. They sent me home around 10 o'clock. So we get to the hospital right around, I don't know, 7:15, 7. The hospital was 100 yards away. But she sent me home because I was so... And she said, well, just go home. I mean, again, it's 100 yards away. So go home and just kind of relax, which means a bottle of 1800 tequila. My brother by that time was there. And I guess I probably drank half that bottle while he peeled the labels off it because he has this obsessive compulsive disease thing where he just peels labels off bottles. It's weird. And about 2 a.m, they called me and said, well, we're going to do the C-section. Come on over. And so I did. And I wasn't drunk, but I was, you know, I was certainly not feeling any pain at that point. And everything went well. And Ben is here, and it's hard to believe that he's going to be 8 tomorrow. And it just, it's, you know, I struggle with this because he's 8, which means that I'm 55 this year. And it's, I'll tell you, it's a strange thing to know that when my son graduates from high school, I'll be 65 years old. I have a hard time with that. I struggle with that because it's, you know, I'm blessed. I've had my father in my life my entire life. I mean, my dad has always been there. But I start realizing, you know, that in Ben's case, you know, the odds are a little bit different at this point. I mean, it's not likely that I'm going to be there when he's 55 like I am. It's just a little far-fetched. And there's a part of me that's bitter about that. There's a part of me that has a real hard time dealing with that. And I have a hard time each time he gets a little bit older. What I realize is that means I'm getting a little bit older. And, you know, when you're 8, life seems like it stretches out way in front of you. When you're 55 and you start reading about people in your business who are dying at 64 and 63 and 66, it it grates on you a little bit. I mean, it really does. In the 2 weeks that we've been since we had the ship's reunion, we've lost another shipmate who was 59. And it just sort of, you know, it does get depressing. And then when we go out to the lake, Ben, a year ago when we went, you know, out for this, He was terrified of the water. I mean, he would play in the shallow water. He would play on the little raft thing, but he wouldn't get off of that. He would just hang out on that raft. And when we went out on the motorboat with the inner tube, he would not get on the inner tube. I mean, his cousin begged him to get on the inner tube with him. Come on, Ben, I'll go with you. Uncle Rob was saying, I'll go slow. No, I'm too scared. And all he talked about for a week before we went out there was he was going to ride the inner tube, you know, with his cousin. I'm going to ride with my cousin. And then when we get there, his cousin, who is 5 years older than he is, had somewhat of interest with him, who he was far more interested in spending time with than his 8-year-old cousin. And so when it came time to ride the tubes, Ben was like, well, I'll just do it myself. And I was stunned. I was like, are you serious? You're really going to do this by yourself? And of course, the fears of everything. And he swims very well. He's a very strong swimmer. He's got a life vest on. But, you know, I'm just like, Anyway, he got on the inner tube and he rode it. He rode that inner tube himself. And, you know, Uncle Rob's driving the boat and he is taking it easy, but, you know, he started revving it up a little bit at the end there too. And Ben did just fine with it. And it just, when it was all said and done, I was so proud of him. And at the same time, it was like, here's one more thing that he's doing without me. I mean, in the last month, he's gone to riding the inner tubes, to no training wheels on his bike, to flying drones, to passing swim tests. And it just makes me feel really, what's the word for it? I guess depressed is one way to look at it. I just feel really old and really, I guess, kind of bitter about not, you know, I'm not going to be there for his whole life. And it's harder than I thought it would be, especially when I think back about this night, you know, 8 years ago. It was, you hold that little boy in your hand and he's the size of a football, and now he's, you know, he's getting big and he's getting strong. He can almost beat me at thumb wrestling now, almost. And then I came across this article. You know, I read a lot of stuff, and I don't normally read Sports Illustrated, but sometimes there are some things I do. And this is an article last week about, was it last week? Yeah, July 5th, came out the day after. In the middle of this depression that I'm having about Ben getting older, comes out this article about Johnny Bench. Now, for those of you who don't know, Johnny Bench is a former Major League Baseball catcher. He played for the Cincinnati Reds back in the 70s and 80s, and he's from Oklahoma City, like I am. Born there. He doesn't live there anymore. Neither do I, because let's face it, it's Oklahoma City. But Johnny Bench is 70 years old. And he is essentially starting over with his kids again. He has two brothers, two sons, 12 and 8. And he's raising his 8-year-old son at 70 years old. And as I'm reading through this, it came across this moment, this quote, and it says, if life at 70 is different than the way he imagined, Bench points out that it's also irrelevant. You know, here I am. I'm so worried about being there for Ben for so long, and I'm a historian, so I look at the past, and sometimes we forget about what really matters. What matters is now, Ben says. I want these boys to be well-raised and well-behaved and well-educated. It's a commitment, but I've made that commitment to them, and I'm happy to have it. What matters is now. And I got to tell you, this cloud of gloom that was over my head over the last week just sort of broke apart. It just sort of faded away, and just like the weather here is getting really nice. It really kind of brightened up my day to think that one of my childhood heroes, one of the people that inspired me to play catcher for years, is going through such a similar experience. And you know, as a kid, I can draw from him. As a player, I can look at him and try to emulate him. And as you know, he can kind of inspire you. And I remember his final year, all of those things, and here it is all these years later. And once again, Johnny Bench is still inspiring me. He's still saying things that I needed to hear. What matters is today. Ben's going to be 9 tomorrow. We're going to have a lot of fun. His birthday party's not till Thursday or Friday when everybody can be here. But he and I are going to have some fun tomorrow. I may just carry him around with a mask on my face again, like I did that first day. Just for nostalgia's sake, just to see if any of that really rings back in his knees. He was the gold standard, and he may still very well be the gold standard of catchers. I know he sure made my Independence Day week a whole lot better. That's what matters. Sorry, I keep dropping my pen there. Not sure why that keeps happening. That's weird. So, what we will not be talking about today is the Supreme Court nomination that is expected to happen tonight. There's a couple reasons why. I actually have a list here. It's over there on the far side of the desk of these six most several lists. There's a 25-man list or 25-person list. There's a 6-person list. There's a 3-person list. An extensive analysis of each one of them and what they would bring to the court and who they are and what they've done. And none of that matters because most people listen to this show in catch-up mode. that is downstream. Many of the people that will hear this show actually won't hear it until tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday. They're catching up later on. And so to sit here and do a bunch of analysis about Supreme Court, potential Supreme Court nominees, seemed a little silly to me, because by the time most people hear it, it would be out of date. And so I just sort of made the decision today not to talk about Supreme Court nominees. And I'm not gonna. And then I got an email this morning from listener Steve in Philadelphia, who was talking about how he was just frustrated because it's Monday morning and I've heard a week's worth of hate and vitriol and you know, propaganda about Supreme Court justices. It's not even been an hour yet, and I'm already fed up with it. And I thought, I don't really want to get into that. We've got tomorrow. The announcement doesn't come until prime time tonight. I believe it's 6 p.m. Pacific time, 9 p.m. Eastern time. The president is scheduled to make a national address, and that's when he will announce his pick. So I thought, well, we'll just wait for that. We'll see who the actual pick is, because we could burn up a lot of Rolaids and Prilosec talking about it right now. Who it should be, why the left is worried about that, why the right is worried about it. We could do all of that, but none of that's going to really matter, because at the end of the day, it's his pick, and it won't happen until tonight. So if you tuned in today expecting Supreme Court discussion, well, sorry, you're going to have to wait on that until tomorrow when we actually have something to discuss, which we really don't today. So there you have it. But speaking of weird politicians, and we kind of are, I don't speak Spanish very well. I just don't. I can follow, if I'm listening to a conversation, I can kind of almost follow it. I actually have a very hard time reading it, but hearing it, once upon a time, long time ago, 1992, I got sent to South Florida, Homestead, Florida, after Hurricane Andrew, and I was doing some disaster relief work down there, and I spent enough time down there that I got to the point where I could follow a conversation. I wasn't going to pick up every word, but I could follow contextually what was happening, and I could understand things well enough that I could participate, you know, in what was going on. So it is with some interest that I've watched the election down in Mexico last week, which ended up with the populist leftist winning the election. And it is the reaction to that which has been particularly of interest to me. Here's a guy that ran on what is essentially, I don't really know how to describe it because I don't follow Mexican politics all that closely, but it appears to me that this guy is basically an anti-Trump leftist populist appealing to progressive mentalities. And of course, as soon as he got elected, he was on the phone to Trump saying, hey, we need to work together and we need to be friends and yada, yada, yada. But I also have friends who are from Mexico and who are, you know, talking about this extensively. And again, I don't follow all the conversations and I don't always trust the translation fixtures on the various social media platforms. They are blown away by this guy, and particularly one of them is deeply concerned about this guy's decision to do away with the, I don't know what they call it. We would call it the Secret Service, but the guards for the Mexican president. The president of Mexico goes around, he has an armed entourage that guards him from the rather violent culture in Mexico. If you've been following the news, you know that numerous judges, numerous politicians, political figures, especially mayors, have been just brutally assassinated in Mexico over the past few years. And it seems like it's getting worse rather than better. And so this president wins election and he just announces, well, I'm not going to have an armed protection. The people will protect me. The people will protect me from the drug cartels and the violent people and all of that kind of stuff. And so it's kind of a, you know, as we've talked about last week, the assassination of James Garfield, we didn't talk about it on the show, but the history of that, you know, our presidents used to walk in the public as well. They used to go to the theater. They used to go into crowds and give speeches. They used to drive around in open limousines. But we discovered that that is kind of an unnecessary risk, and it's kind of a dangerous thing to do. And so it's kind of surprising when a president in a very violent country, imagine Chicago all across the country for the most part, decides to do away with his protection people, and he's just going to ride around and walk around, and the people will protect him, he says. It appears that there might be more to it than that. If I'm following the conversation correctly, and that could be, you know, again, there's a translation issue here, but if I'm following the conversation correctly, it appears that he is actually forming I'm confused on the number. It's either 40,000 or 400,000 man, person, force to protect him and his government made from the people, as it were. He's forming his own private army. And, of course, that has people really nervous because you don't want a leader of a Western liberal democracy forming his own little private army. People get nervous when that kind of stuff happens. People get drawn to history and they go, okay, what kind of leaders have had private personal armies guarding them as they wandered around through the people? What kind of people, leaders in Western democracies, Western liberal democracies throughout history have done away with protective services and use their own privately funded, privately recruited, privately controlled groups to guard them as they went through their day-to-day activities. And you generally come up with people who are not well regarded in history. They did not work and play well with others. And it's causing a lot of consternation among some of my Mexican friends who are concerned about this. What's going on? Why is this guy doing this? Especially when you got a populist leftist type thing. And remember, most totalitarian dictatorships come from a leftist viewpoint. I know there's a tendency to say, well, they're right wing, but they're not. They're left wing. They are socialists. They are communists. There are very few capitalist dictatorships when you get right down to it. There are very few free market dictatorships. Most of them are, you know, of the left brand. Now, there is a certain element of nationalism in it, and nationalism is generally associated with the right, but not always. And so there's a tendency to do that. Anyway, there's a lot of concern about whether this guy is trying to become a dictator or not. And it is making people uncomfortable. And when you consider Mexico's relationship with the United States, I mean, we share a border, some of which apparently we're going to build a wall across. I don't want to get started on the wall. I really don't. I know. I'm a conservative chat show host, so I'm supposed to be build the wall, build the wall, build the wall. But then I go back to Patton. Monuments or fortifications are monuments to the stupidity of man. You build a wall, people go around it, unless you're willing to shoot people who go around it or under it. If you're not willing to shoot, if you're not willing to defend the wall, people just go around it somehow or another. They go under it, they go over it, they go around it, they go through it. In the case of the Great Wall of China, I'm just not convinced that a wall is the solution to our immigration problems with Mexico. But be that as it may, you've got this now populist leftist president who is apparently, if I'm understanding the translation right, forming his own private army, force, whatever you want to call them, and it's creating some discomfort amongst people who are looking at this going, well, wait a minute, what the devil is going on here? And are we really prepared to deal with what might happen? And there are all kinds of scenarios here. I mean, he forms his own force. Do they go after the cartels? I mean, I don't know how powerful, I don't know how strong the cartels really are. I know they have this mystique about them where they're undefeatable and they're, you know, nobody can take them on. But is that true or is it just mystique? Is it, are they really that big or are they just, you know, a few people that are that violent and that outrageous that they can influence things that way? And if this guy starts forming a 40,000, 400,000 man, an army of his own, you know, what happens when one of them does take a pot shot at the president? Because it's inevitable. I especially someone who's basically waving the red cape in front of them like that. It's not like he's, you know, I'm not talking about cowering behind all stuff, but to actively go out there like, well, the people will protect me from you is basically waving a red flag in front of him and saying, you can't do nothing to me. And of course, nothing tempts a feller worse than being told he can't do it, wrote Mark Twain once upon a time. And you might end up with a situation where they just do it just because they're being told they can't. And nobody likes that. Nobody likes being told that they can't do something, right? Anyway, I just thought it was a fascinating look at our next door neighbor country. Well, our southern neighbor country, because we have next door neighbors to the north too, who are also weird, but it is Canada, so they apologize for it all the time. Anyway, the point being that I just thought it was kind of an interesting look at what's going on down there. And of course it's going to have that relationship with Trump and how that goes forward with the wall and the discussions about immigration and those kinds of things will be intriguing to watch, especially if the cartels start getting involved with this. Might be something to watch. Anyway, we got other stuff to get on to, the Korean thing. I want to get into this Japan execution. Japan executed 6 people last week. I don't know if you knew that or not. They did it very quietly. Well, there were news articles about it, don't get me wrong, but they weren't, you know, I mean, it wasn't shouted into the air, but it was an intriguing story because it's something that points to something that I've come to believe very fervently, particularly about terrorism. And well, this is how those stories kind of end. It's 1:30 the hour. It is the Dave Bowman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You want to join me? The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. Email is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back right after this.
This is the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Being around too much loud noise like a leaf blower or rock concert can cause permanent hearing loss. And once it's gone, you can't get it back. Hearing loss is the third most common chronic health condition in the U.S. Almost twice as many people report hearing loss as diabetes or cancer. The louder a sound is, and the longer you're exposed to it, the more likely it will damage your hearing. Repeated exposure to noise can cause stress, anxiety, depression, high blood pressure, heart disease, and many other problems. Hearing loss from loud noise at home and in the community can be prevented. Avoid noisy places. Use earplugs, protective earmuffs, or noise-canceling headphones when near loud noises. Keep the volume down when watching TV or listening to music and using earbuds or headphones. Get your hearing checked and ask your healthcare provider how to protect your hearing from noise. To learn more, visit cdc.gov/vitalsigns.
Hi, I'm Gerald McRaney.
Is there anything you wouldn't do to live longer or feel better? Would you make a few simple changes in your lifestyle if you knew it could save your life? Take cholesterol. A high blood cholesterol level can cause strokes and serious heart disease. But exercise and simple changes in your diet can reduce cholesterol and make you feel better.
For your free booklet, visit the Will Rogers Institute at WRinstitute.org or call toll-free 877-957-7575 and find us on Facebook and Twitter. The Will Rogers Institute, since 1936.
Science Underground with your host, Anissa Ramirez.
This week, how animals communicate. I'm Anissa Ramirez, and this is
Science Underground.
Dogs bark, cats meow, ducks quack. These sounds may not seem like anything to us, but to animals, they're communicating. To understand more, I talked to Khan Slobachikov. He studies the language of animals, specifically the prairie dog.
Prairie dogs have different words for different predators. So, for example, they have a word for hawk. They have another word for a coyote, another word for a domestic dog, another word for a human.
Not only do prairie dogs have nouns in their vernacular, but adjectives too. Now, listening to the prairie dog doesn't sound like much.
Basically, they sound like a bird chirping, like a... So they last a tenth of a second, and this is why people have assumed in the past that there's no information in there, because it just lasts a tenth of a second.
But there's a lot being said in that split second. The reason is that animals have a different sense of time.
Different animals operate on different time scales. So a chirp, say, for a prairie dog might be the equivalent to a whole sentence for us. Animals have different time scales, and that does relate to their length of life.
If you take a prairie dog's chirp and slow it down 16 times, it sounds like someone is pronouncing a sentence. You see, prairie dogs live for about 5 years, and they speak with chirps. Humans live for about 80 years and speak much longer. There seems to be a relationship, but much more evidence is needed. What is certain is that animals have lots to say, and if we listen at the right speed, we might be able to talk to the animals. I'm Anissa Ramirez, and this was
Science Underground.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
All right.
You are listening to The Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back. Hopefully you used your break time wisely. Join me again. Area code 209-565-DAVE is the text machine. We're also on the YouTube chat room. Don't get too used to that, though. We're headed in another direction. We don't have the technology completely in place yet, so. But we're headed another way. So, last week, Japan did something really interesting to me, and this is how my mind works. I look at things happening, and I have my opinions about things. And I will tell you that for 10 years on the radio, as a conservative chat show host radio, I coined the term PLRI, the Peace-Loving Religion of Islam, as something of a sarcastic jab at a faith that, in my opinion, is flawed. Anybody that believes that you need God to kill for you, your God's a wussy. That's, well, you know what, on the internet now, your God's a pussy. If your God needs you to kill for you, for it, can't handle the job himself, there's something wrong with your God. You need another belief system. But in the years since then, And, you know, I've been off the terrestrial radio now for about 5 years. Four years. Is it 3 years? I left in January of 2015. So 3 years, 3.5 years. Anyway, the point being that it's something that I started looking at a lot closer, terrorism in general. Because when you look at the use of terrorism, and this kind of relates across the board, it relates to this ongoing war on terror, this war without end, this war that continues to operate on a 2001, 2003 authorization for the use of military force. There's no debate. There's no discussion. There's no national outcry. Nobody. I mean, Code Pink isn't even, you don't even hear about them anymore. There's no anti-war movement that makes us face a national debate over whether or not what we're doing is useful. And again, I've said this before, I'm the hawk here. I don't have a conceptual problem with a long war. I don't, if as long as we know what we're doing, I don't have a problem with it, but I'm becoming less and less convinced that we know what we're doing. And we're more about just putting American troops and stuff anywhere and everywhere we can find. I mean, 54 out of 57 African country, 54 out of 55, whatever it is, have American troops on the ground. We got boots on the ground in Syria. Did we ever discuss that? Did we ever have a debate about that? By the way, that war is one of the most fascinating stories I read a couple of weeks ago, and I never did get into it on the show, was the rebels are losing. The side that we backed has lost the Syrian war. They're just in mop-up mode right now. The Russians and the Syrians are just in mop-up mode. And we, I guess, sent them an email the other day, or a letter or something, saying, look, you're on your own. We're not going to help you. And no, it got nothing. No play at all in the media. But all of this is based on this idea of terrorism as a political weapon. All this is based on this idea that, you know, ISIL wants to establish a caliphate, that PLRI terrorism in general is about, you know, establishing, about political goals, destroying Israel, destroying the great Satan, you know, that sort of thing. But what I've learned along the way is it's so much less politics and more religion. ISIL was a doomsday cult. Did you know that? A lot of people don't know this. They don't understand this. The whole purpose of ISIL, ISIS, IS, whatever the hell you want to call them, the whole purpose of that had nothing to do with politics. It was all about bringing around the end of the world. If we accomplish this, we believe that our God, our Imam, or whatever the heck it is, will reward our efforts by ending the world. And of course, most eschatology, most religious eschatology, deals with the end of the world as a reward for its believers. And at the end of the world, believers are rewarded, even in Christianity. Oh yeah, there's going to be a tribulation, and then there's a thousand-year millennium, then a battle of Armageddon, depending on which version of eschatology you adhere to. But at the end of it, all the bad people will be smitten by Jesus, and then the rest of you will live happily ever after, right? I mean, even Christianity has that with a major battle at Armageddon. And there are those, even in the realm of Christendom, whether you agree with them being Christians or not, there are those who have attempted to bring around the end of the world by creating conflicts. The whole issue in Waco back in the 90s was about end of the world eschatology. It was about the end of the world, and the believers would be rewarded after the battle was done. ISIS was about the same thing. ISIL, ISIS, IS, whatever, was about the same thing, bringing around the end of the world by creating this conflict, which might have political implications, but really, if you don't understand the religious element of it, you don't really comprehend what they're doing, which is why this war on terror, particularly against Islamic terrorism, is more likely to not go anywhere because of the fact that it's politically, our ideology is political. We want to make the world safe from terrorism. But that's not consistent with our belief that you can believe whatever you want. religiously. And so you got people who religiously believe that if they act a certain way, it will bring around the end of the world. Well, Japan had that back in the 90s. And I always butcher this name, Om Shinrikyo cult, led by a guy by the name of Shoko Asahara. In March of 1995, they believed that they could bring around the end of the world with this odd, I don't even know how to describe it, bizarre combination of Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, and other religions that they had melded together into this bizarre religious philosophy that they could bring around the end of the world by creating a terrorist attack. And so on March 20th, 1995, the members of the Shinrikyo took a bunch of plastic bags filled with nerve gas, sarin nerve gas, onto the subway system. They poked holes in it and let it out on the subway system in Tokyo. Now, this is one of the busiest subway systems in the world. I mean, we as Americans, we have places that have subways, New York, Washington, D.C., but we don't use them the way that people in Japan or England or wherever use them. In Japan, it's, you know, I've got a friend that's been in Japan, stationed in Japan for years, and he could tell you stories about the way that they use trains and public transportation. It's different than the way we use it. It's almost a necessity there. And so all these people on this call, and they release sarin gas. 13 people end up dying. 6,000 are made ill. 6,000 people are made ill by this attack designed, at least in the minds of the people who carried it out, to bring around the end of the world. Now, look, we could spend a lot of time talking, you know, religious beliefs and religious faiths and crazy religious beliefs, but the fact of the matter is that virtually all of us belong to some form of religion, faith, that has some element of eschatology in it that believes that the end of the world is a good thing for the people who adhere to that religion. Right? And through the years, we have debated, argument. most of you know, I used to be a pastor. I used to be a Christian. I'm not. I'm Jewish now. I converted in 2008. The debates you could get into over the end time eschatology were, I don't know. At one point, I put a moratorium in my congregation about the book of Revelation and the book of Daniel. So we're just not even going to, it's, there are too many arguments and not enough actual answers to deal with what's going on here. And the problem, of course, is that everybody knows that they are right. Everybody you talk to knows that they are right, whether they are pre-trib, post-trib, mid-trib, whatever. And you can't convince anybody. You can't change anybody's mind. But at the end of the day, no matter how you face it, this death, destruction, war, all of this stuff ends up good for the people who adhere to whatever faith it is. Even in Judaism, we have an element of eschatological belief that the world to come will be better. But it has to be, it's going to be bad first, even though we have this philosophy of Tikkat Olam, which is to heal the world. There's elements of this, and there's arguments about that. And, of course, in Islam, you have the same ideology, particularly on the side of the ISIL people who believe that they can destroy the world and they'll get their virgins for it. More terrorism, the more you look at terrorism around the world, the more you find that it's religiously based. It's not politically based. There's some political ideology to it. But more than that, it's religiously based. And it's becoming more and more common in the 21st century and in the late 20th century. It is becoming more and more common that it is doomsday in nature. It is an attempt to destroy the world to bring about nirvana or Valhalla or heaven or whatever. And this Om Shinrikyo, they were trying to do the same thing. They were trying to bring about the end of the world which, of course, would reward the people who adhered to this bizarre cult that drew from every religion you could possibly make of. At any rate, this happened in 1995. And last week, the leader of that cult, Shoko Asahara, and six of his compatriots and most complicit with the attack were hung, executed by Japan. And you don't really think about the debate over capital punishment in Japan, because we just sort of assume that there's almost this attitude that, well, it doesn't happen. I mean, here in the United States, there's not an execution that happens in the United States without being front page news. And this debate over whether or not capital punishment is right, or whether we're taking away somebody's life within the context of the Constitution, is it cruel and unusual punishment? There's none of that debate in Japan. They have a process, which is a rather lengthy process, as you can tell, and there's very little concern about, cruel and unusual or anything like that. And then there's obviously the part that looks at this and goes, these people killed 13 people and injured 6,000, some of whom quite badly, many of whom never really fully recovered, and we don't really care. Most of them are saying things like, well, let's see, this gave me peace of mind, said Kiyoi Iwata, who lost her daughter in the subway attack. I've always been wondering why it had to be my daughter and why she had to be killed. Now I can pay a visit to her grave and tell her of this. The cult also carried out other crimes that killed 27 people in total, and there are six more on death row. The others hanged on Friday included two scientists who led the production of the sarin gas and one of the men who was actually carried out the attack. And then you start reading about the actual cult. It was founded in 1984. It attracted many young people, graduates of top university. It amassed an arsenal of chemical, biological, and conventional weapons in anticipation of an apocalyptic showdown with the government. They claim to have 10,000 members in Japan, 30,000 in Russia. And though it has officially disbanded, nearly 2,000 people still follow its rituals today. I find it a fascinating story. I really did, for a lot of reasons. Number one, because it's evidence that reminds us that many, if not most, terrorist action is more religious-based than it is ideologically-based, or politically-based, I guess is a better way to say that. Where, as we look at our own conflict against terrorism, the global war on terrorism, we have to start asking ourselves the question, what are we really battling here? What are we really facing in our conflict? Is it a political ideology that, we on the right, we tend to go, well, they're going to take over our country and they're going to do this and they're going to do that. But is it really that? And how does that, again, how does that mesh with our own ideas about freedom of religion? Now, again, I'm not advocating that if your religion believes that you have to roast virgins at midnight on Friday, you should be allowed to do that. That's not what I'm saying. No belief, well, as Thomas Jefferson, your belief ends where it violates somebody else's right. Your actions are legislatable. Your beliefs are not. You can do whatever you want to do belief-wise. You can believe whatever you want, but you can't necessarily take those actions, and we can pass laws to, to deal with that. So, but as we go around the world, and we say we're fighting this global war on terror, the people who are on that side understand this innately, that they are fighting a religious war. They are trying to bring around the end of the world. That's what's preached to them every Friday at the mosques. It's what Shokahara told his followers. Can you begin to see why they then respond with, the United States has declared a war on fill-in-the-blank religion. Do you start to see why they see it a little bit differently than we see it? We see it as a political ideology. They see it as a religious ideology. Now, again, you could argue that their religious ideology is political, and I'm certainly willing to have that discussion because they want to do things from a political nature based in their religion. Particularly when you're talking about the PLRI, you're talking about a very odd mixture here of theocracy versus, you know, what we perceived as separation of church and state. In many religions around the world, there is no separation of church and state. Even in England, technically, there isn't. The Queen, the head of the government, is also the head of the church. It just gets you thinking sometimes, and it gets your, you know, to me, it makes me sit here and go, okay, again, we're fighting a war, and if you were to ask anybody, what is the goal? What is the aim? How will we know when we win this war? What answer will you get? What answer does the government offer us? What are we told by our congresspeople, our senators, our presidents? Well, we're keeping you safe. We're keeping you safe from the terrorists. Okay. So isn't that, you know, kind of a law enforcement thing? Again, I'm not philosophically opposed to the idea of a long, drawn-out conflict if the conflict has meaning and a direction to go and a reason. I'm starting to question whether we have that and whether or not we've discussed it fully. And because, again, there is no reasonable or even unreasonable anti-war movement, we're not having that discussion. You could apply these same standards to Vietnam. I mean, you really could, not necessarily religious, but the same. We never understood the real ideology. You know, we said it's communist, and to the degree that it was political, it was, but we never really understood the ideology of the North. We never really understood why they were doing this. I mean, geez, we dropped more bombs on North Vietnam than we did in World War II. At some point, somewhere, you would think that they would say, this is crazy, we're going to give up, we're not going to do this. We never really understood that, and because of the draft and the anti-war movement, we were forced to discuss it and debate it as to whether it was worth it to us. And every time we lose another soldier, sailor, airman, marine, coastie, somewhere in the world, do we discuss whether or not it's worth it anymore? Or do we just say, they're keeping us safe from the religious nutballs? Or do we actually discuss why we're doing this stuff? My solution is to bring back the draft. Without the draft, there will be no discussion. Without the draft, there's no viable anti-war movement. Without the draft, there is no equality in who is serving and who is being killed. It's all volunteers, and I get that. Believe me, I understand that, and I'm proud of that. But it's also setting up a separate caste of society, a separate, you know, it's setting up a separated, you know, section of society that doesn't connect with the other. There's no interface between the two. We're the professional military and you're not. Right? And once you start heading down that road with, you know, we're the professionals and you're not, it's a whole lot easier to just dismiss concerns about things. It's how you end up with civil servants that are presumptive about things and don't think the rules apply to them. It's a little unnerving to me. And as you know, Ben turns 8 tomorrow, I just start wondering what the future of the world is going to be. And have we done enough to make it safe, to make it secure? For so long, I believed that what we did in the Cold War, in winning the Cold War, in destroying the Soviet Union and its communist ideology, in preserving the peace and making sure that nobody would be insane enough to use a nuclear weapon because, you know, deterrence. I believed for my entire life that it was the right thing to do and that it was worth doing and that we did it well and that we had accomplished our mission. But the world's changed. The world has changed. And now I'm starting to wonder. Now I'm getting concerned. And I'm very concerned that we're not talking about it, that we're not discussing it, that we don't seem to care. We just sort of go, stuff happens. My son turns 8. And I know I'm not going to be there for when he's 50, like my dad is. But I also know that today is the day that matters. Today is the day that we'll talk about something that he will take with him for the rest of his life. Today is the day that I will make sure that he is well-educated and well-behaved. Because really, at the end of the day, that's all I can, it's all I can do. Handle today. And with any kind of luck, if I do that right, well, then things will go well. The future will be safe. It's just something to think about. I didn't get the Hillary running. I also didn't get the North Korea. Tomorrow will be Supreme Court stuff, so maybe we'll get to it, maybe we won't. There's a... you know what? Tim's up coming up next. He's going to talk about this Hillary thing anyway, so... You can stay here on the Podcast 99 and listen to Tim as he talks about Hillary Clinton running in 2020. Isn't it an insane idea? I think she's thinking about it, but I also don't think it's realistic. I don't see any way that it happens. And we'll probably get into the North Korean stuff later on in the week because there's some funky stuff happening with that. But that's all we got time for today. I got to get going and. You got other stuff to do, and I've got other stuff to do, and Tim wants the microphone, so he's coming up pretty much next. All right, take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there, so don't pass those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman. This is my show, The Dave Bowman Show, on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Check us out at podcast99.org or my show at thedavebowmanshow.com. Have a great day, everybody, and we will see you tomorrow for a Tuesday episode of the Dave Bowman Show.
Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to the DaveBowmanShow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.